Chapter 5. The Postmodern Condition. Confidence in Truth. One of the central themes of all that has gone before might be summarized as realism lost, and along with it, a reliable sense of past history. Indeed, Frederick Jameson points to a defining sense of the postmodern as the disappearance of a sense of history in the culture, a pervasive depthlessness, a perpetual present in which the memory of tradition is gone. For many postmodernists, there was something in the very condition of society that brought this about. As we have seen, much postmodernist analysis is an attack on authority and reliability in philosophy, narrative, and the relationship of the arts to truth. All this skeptical activity has a complex relationship, not just to the attitudes of academics and artists, but to what was seen as a more general loss of confidence within Western democratic culture. Left-wing hostility to the hidden manipulations of late capitalism, and the quite general belief, even among the most optimistic of liberals, that real news is too often subordinated to image manipulation, that the dissemination of basic information is always distorted by business corporate interests, and that even horrifyingly immediate events, which cause unimaginable suffering to individuals, like the Vietnam and Gulf Wars, had become in some way just dramatized media events, which take place on TV, in scenes constructed for political ends by the cameras, the sniper with the camera over his shoulder, the speechmaker's hopes for the better on the White House lawn, and so on. There is a strong feeling through the work of critics like Barthes to the novels of Milan Kundera and Rushdie that the political and historical event always reaches us in a fictionalized form, in a narrative, massaged by the more or less hidden hand of political or economic purposes. It is not difficult to appreciate how well TV works as the chief disseminator of such fictionalized information. There is so much of it, it is so contradictory, so obviously motivated by hegemonic economic interests, so commodified, so much to be distrusted. It's an obvious target, because the medium seems to rely on the realist, transparent presentation which we associate with photography, and this very fact invites postmodernist skepticism. Unreal images. This feeling that the mass media substitute images for reality arises in various ways, from the Marxist presupposition that we are all, in any case, the victims of a false consciousness brought about by bourgeois discourse, through to the liberal distrust of corporate restraints on free speech. The problem is that this attack on truthful realism, ever since indeed the moderns turned against that of the 19th century, has by now gone on so long that for many a distrust of the fictional has indeed driven out a confidence in the true, as we saw in the controversy over the writing of history. Jameson, as a Marxist, likes the thought that there is a general crisis of representation. His idea is that with postmodernity, signs have been relieved of their function of referring to the world, and this brings about the expansion of the power of capital into the realm of the sign, of culture and representation, along with the collapse of modernism's prized space of autonomy. He writes in Postmodernism and the Video Text, in The Linguistics of Writing from 1987, "We are left with that pure and random play of signifiers which we call postmodernism, which no longer produces monumental works of the modernist type, but ceaselessly reshuffles the fragments of pre-existent texts, the building blocks of older cultural and social production in a heightened bricolage, meta-books which cannibalize other books, meta-texts which collate bits of other texts." For many postmodernists, we live in a society of the image, primarily concerned with the production and consumption of mere simulacra. Information by now is just something that we buy. And perhaps the main thing that we buy in a knowledge-dominated, technologically-driven society. We are always trying to learn a new bit of software. A skeptical despair about the reality of politics and the institutions of our common social life, TV and newspapers, reinforces a skeptical despair about the progressive or conciliatory functions of art. The Nietzschean assumption that all such phenomena, from statements from the White House to everyday soap operas, are more or less secretly in the service of the maintenance of the power, economic and other, of somebody or other, rather than made in the service of any truth, is all-pervasive. It has led to a peculiarly paranoid strain in postmodernist theory and art, as well as in those popular films concerned with real or fictional conspiracies. How many people believe that Oliver Stone's film JFK, which presents us with a New Orleans attorney heroically confronting those in the military establishment who conspired to assassinate Kennedy in order to keep the United States fighting in Vietnam, is not the fiction it is, but the truth? Perhaps the most celebratedly outrageous assertion of the essential unreality of the culture in which we live was made by Jean Baudrillard, who echoed Foucault in arguing that Disneyland is there to conceal the fact that it is the real country, all of real America, which is Disneyland. Just as prisons are there to conceal the fact that it is the social, in its entirety, in its banal omnipresence, which is carceral. He goes on to say in Simulations, from 1983, that Disneyland, with its pirates, frontier, and future world fantasy setups, is presented as imaginary in order to make us believe that the rest is real, when in fact all of Los Angeles and the America surrounding it are no longer real, but of the order of the hyperreal and of simulation. It is no longer a question of a false representation of reality, ideology, but of concealing the fact that the real is no longer real, and thus of saving the reality principle. The Disneyland imaginary is neither true nor false. It is a deterrence machine set up in order to rejuvenate in reverse the fiction of the real. We are simply enclosed in a media-dominated world of signs, villainously generated by capitalism to synthesize our desires, which only really refer to one another within an entrapping chain of ideas. They are mere simulacra, which replace real things and their actual relationships, only truly known to those on the left who see through such illusions, in a process which Baudrillard calls hyper-realization. So we never really get what we want anyway, but we might on the contrary say that we do indeed get what we pay for, however it is advertised. A McDonald's hamburger is a McDonald's hamburger in all its billions of exemplifiers. And to many, it really does taste pretty good. And if you smell of Dune perfume, you smell of Dune perfume. All this is not mere sign play, however much advertising might try to induce us to buy into it. But even those of us who have not read any postmodernist theory are not completely taken in, and don't really believe that anybody else is much. Read the opinion polls on politicians worldwide, or even market research on the effects of advertising. But to hear Baudrillard and others like him, you would think we ate, drank, and slept on and with mere signifiers. Up to a point. This sort of argument combines the old liberal attack on advertising, as synthesizing wants that we don't really have, with a bit of pessimistic Freudianism. Signs for objects always deceive, and one can never get back through them to the really desired object. A replica of the Lascaux Caves in France has displaced the real Lascaux. It really makes no difference, we are asked to believe. But even the most naive of Lascaux's visitors could easily be made to understand how they, let alone an art historian, can tell the difference between the real and a fake, and also even to understand conservationist reasons, if there are any, for the use of a replica for tourists. Postmodernists are by and large pessimists, many of them haunted by lost Marxist revolutionary hopes, and the beliefs and the art they inspire are often negative rather than constructive. Mass affluence is not good, because when people have what they basically need, advertising and marketing move into the gap to synthesize and define our materialist values for us, and those who do need are the more easily forgotten. Marketing thus takes precedence over production. We have the sense that even justice is or can become a media event, as in the trial of O.J. Simpson shown on TV, so clearly influenced by the exaggerated play-acting of advocates, the carefully chosen clothing of the actors in the drama, and the politically slanted, stereotypically prejudiced soundbite summaries of lawyers and TV journalists. The whole thing can seem sickeningly fictional, as all participants manipulate opinion through the media by hypercritically approximating themselves to what they believe to be approved role models and fictional stereotypes. We may well ask, how is justice of a disinterested kind to be done on such a stage? Are judge and jury, who are, after all, in the end, only one of us, really going to be taken in by all this shameless role-playing? Or are the procedures of justice in court somehow to be thought of as more reliable than that? There is room for doubt about this in all of us, and it is that doubt that postmodernists, and indeed the writers of many courtroom thrillers, rightly insist upon. But they also tend to give a misleadingly pessimistic account of the information we receive and of conflict and its resolution. Many of them, in fact, belong to a long post-Nietzschean tradition of despair about reason. Incorrectly seeing all discourses as inherently related to the power systems that might be thought to back them up, as expressing power, they can give the impression that our culture is not much more than a complex interaction of opposing threats of force. Their skepticism about truth often deprives them of a proper concern for the activities of reason-giving and rational negotiation, and for procedural justice. The background influence of Marx and Freud too often implies that everything we say carries the authority and the threat of race, class, rank, and sexual power play. But this hardly allows for the function in democratic societies of legal agreements and restraints, or of the moral considerations that lead to the protection of human rights, which really are meant to be universal and not culturally relative or the property of any one group. Nor does it allow for the fact that the attempt to be reasonable and truthful, to back up assertions by verifiable evidence and so on, is essential if we are to come to the negotiating table with something other than implied threats, or to treat the writing of history or theology or the novel as something better than the entrapment of the reader in a mythical narrative. Imagine someone who thought that anything that any American or Israeli or Russian and other politician said was always a form of imperialist or theological or rogue state bullying, simply because it implicitly reflected, say, the power of that nation's political institutions and armed forces. Of course, many proclamations by such persons indeed do this, to horrifying effect, but particularly in cases of conflict, it may be all the more important to locate the voices of the most reasonable persons. For example, those who are most open to a rational conviction concerning the guilt and responsibility that arises out of conflict. The best that one can say here, and I am saying it, is that postmodernists are good critical deconstructors and terrible constructors. They tend to leave that job to those patient liberals in their society who are still willing to attempt to sort out at least some of those differences between truth and fantasy, which postmodernists blur in a whirlwind of pessimistic assumptions about the inevitability of class or psychological conflict. On the other hand, postmodernists have clearly reflected to great purpose on the nature of cultural changes since 1945 into what they call the postmodern condition. This is one in which the global condition of societies is seen not as determined by traditional economic or political frameworks, but as a state of culture. This reliance upon a cultural analysis, now given prominence by a flourishing cultural studies movement heavily influenced so far by postmodernist ideas, is one of the most distinctive contributions of postmodernism to contemporary society. The activities of late capitalism and of Western democracies are obviously going concerns, with no obvious alternative to them currently available, certainly since 1989. Given a general, even if illusory, presumption of continued plenty, they are seen by postmodernists as primarily information-producing rather than object-producing formations, which demand analysis primarily in cultural terms. A postmodernist view of the social changes that have most affected contemporary society would therefore, and I broadly follow David Harvey here, emphasize such matters as the extraordinary compression of time and space through the new media. We can now get simultaneous access via TV and the Internet to events and information in nearly any part of the world. The Internet is at present a typically postmodernist phenomenon. It is, currently, a non-hierarchized, indeed disorganized collage. This goes along with a change from a concentration on the production of goods to a concentration on the production of information services. The story here is that huge fortunes are made or lost every day, not in buying or selling things, but by operations in the money market by traders in front of TV screens, which give them computerized access to more information than ever was available before. For some, this is a symptom of the scandalous superimposition of fluctuating news images or opinion, that of the market makers, over reality. But this is again typical of the postmodern condition. Many of us are working in an incredibly driven, information-soaked world, and those of us who are not are often starving or illiterate or struggling at the bottom of the social heap or mentally ill. There is too much of everything. We are subject everywhere to a sensory overload of images in magazines and advertisements, on the TV, in the cityscape, etc. This was a modernist complaint, too. Mere changes in taste promote the sale of goods, so that fashion takes over from culture, and media-led opinion forming is vital to the economic process. In all of this diagnosis, postmodernists are open to the charge that they seriously overestimate the gullibility of their fellow citizens. Many of their strictures are sheer nannying about the obvious, which hardly merits its respectable disguise in the shreds of theory. And for some, this state of affairs is okay. In the post-McLuhanite global village in which we all now more or less live, held together by electronic contact rather than by genuine social relationships between persons, of course signs may come to count for more than commodities. It is worth asking, then, how far a postmodernist hermeneutics of suspicion is justified. There is in any case a crippling contradiction at the heart of the analysis. If anyone says that everything is really just constituted by a deceiving image and not by reality, how does he or she know? They presuppose the very distinctions they attack. At best, such critics are making a banal and condescending series of remarks about other people's self-deceit, or merely deploring, on well-established liberal moral grounds, the success of the advertising industry, TV, etc., in getting people to consume and to believe things of which they, the critics, disapprove. This is no more distinctive a view than a preference for the views of one politician over another, and it is hardly good evidence for original insight into a radically new condition of contemporary society. The more basic problem lies in the undoubted decline, for a significant minority, of assent to previously popular orthodoxies and ideologies. A postmodernist skeptic, noting the extraordinary range of conflicting versions of reality available to us within a remarkably tolerant and pluralist society, and willing to be a bit of a relativist, might well be inclined to opt for something like Richard Rorty's postmodernist irony. Such ironists have doubts about the truth of any final vocabulary, and realize that others have different ones. They don't see their vocabulary as closer to reality than other people's. They can only worry that they might be playing the wrong kind of language game, and so be the wrong kind of human being. Such a person, Rorty writes in Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity from 1989, is not in the business of supplying himself and his fellow ironists with a method, a platform, or a rationale. He is just doing the same thing that all ironists do, attempting autonomy. He is trying to get out from under inherited contingencies and make his own contingencies. Get out from under an old final vocabulary and fashion one which will be all his own. The generic trait of ironists is that they do not hope to have their doubts about their final vocabularies settled by something larger than themselves. This means that their criterion for resolving doubts, their criterion of private perfection, is autonomy rather than affiliation to a power other than themselves. The idea here is that an awareness of the lack of foundations and the contingency of everything is a good thing. It would be more liberal because discussion of what is possible would be the less constrained, along with an awareness that one's own position in such discussions is relative, in the sense that the opposition's view may be as well-founded. This is for Rorty a kind of existential irony. The ironist has doubts about the vocabulary he or she uses. Others' vocabularies also seem to work well. These doubts cannot be removed by any final answer or foundational position. You can always doubt whether others have not seen more of reality than you can, with your vocabulary, or in the artistic rather than the philosophical or political or moral spheres, we can say that there are lots of ways of making art and no one privileged way of interpreting it. Indeed, philosophy should be a good deal more like literary or artistic criticism than it thinks it is. So the irony really consists in our never being able to take ourselves, or the vocabulary, or the theory, or the artistic genre we employ, entirely seriously. We can no longer, in the postmodernist context, depend on big transcendental knockdown ideas or arguments. We have to rely on each other and on the justificatory outcomes of our local conversations with each other, which include the making of art. The criteria of success will be entirely pragmatic. Vocabularies just succeed one another through history along with their competitors. Some while ago we had Neo Geo painting. Now we have the young British artists and sensation. Political movements are in no better shape than artistic movements in this respect. The move from, say, Thatcherism to New Labour is basically a Rortian change of vocabulary, including all the image-making spin that goes with each government, and not the revelation of new and well-founded political arguments and principles. If this sort of postmodernist view is accepted, we would indeed have a post-Enlightenment form of liberalism. Maybe this ideal is most obviously appealing in the United States, which is by and large committed to multiculturalism, believes in rights and self-improvement, and has a lot of Christian believers within a broadly secular state. It is also an implicitly therapeutic rather than a philosophical view. "Let's talk this one through," it says. But of course, even this recommendation is no more than a recommendation. And if in true postmodernist fashion this ironic form of liberalism were adopted, it would just be one form of life amongst others. This kind of Rortian postmodernism may be more difficult to see as a going concern in Britain, France, or Germany, let alone the post-Soviet states, where many of those who come to the dialogue will have non-negotiable, even if not ex hypothesi, obviously indubitable traditional, Marxist, Christian, Islamic, nationalist positions. But then the skeptical postmodernist rightly says that the problem resides precisely in some people's wholly unjustified certainties. When we ask for constructive dialogue in Northern Ireland, we have also, in the postmodernist view, to ask for some degree of ironic relativism in the main protagonists, and they clearly find this sort of thing hard to come by. Postmodernist beliefs therefore tend to a multiculturalist pluralism and relativism. In doing so, they can too easily or naively accept what is undoubtedly the case, that most of us in the West now believe we live in societies in which traditional perspectives are fractured. Although we may believe in the logic of promise-keeping, can we any longer truly believe in it, in the light of modern realpolitik, in anything like the sense in which Kant and Hume did? These traditional principles and the alternatives to them now seem to lack a firm grounding. As John Gray puts it in Enlightenment's Wake from 1995, "The postmodern condition of plural and provisional perspectives, lacking any rational or transcendental ground or unifying worldview, is our own, given to us as an historical fate, and it is idle to pretend otherwise." However, as I have tried to indicate above, this condition should be resisted and not allowed to justify a kind of ironic indifferentism. The claim to superior deconstructive insight depends on notions of truth. The idea that the self is socially constructed in all sorts of different ways does not seem to be able to destroy the idea that people are individuals who make up the unique narrative of their lives, or the idea that the legal rights of individuals need to be defended in the political context by reference to universal principles or ideals, for example, those of equality before the law. The beliefs which led to the public stoning to death of an adulterous woman are not just to be shrugged off as a symptom of the way they do things over there, as opposed to round here. It looks as though postmodernist relativism, ironic or not, may really not be much more than a disguised plea for a pluralist tolerance, suitable to the very different kinds of personal, sexual, and ethnic positions which have come to so much prominence, in affluent societies at least, in the postmodernist period. Postmodernist thought has done a great deal to point out and to defend the differences of identity involved here. But they still, as a matter of fact, often lead to bitter conflicts, which need to be resolved by something better than postmodernist principles. For some, homosexuality is against their religion. For others, like me, it is a matter of taste, with no inherent moral consequences. And for others, it involves participation in a culture or way of life which may indeed deserve defense as a whole, but can only be asserted as a matter of right if it doesn't adversely affect the rights of others. Given this, many postmodernist thinkers still need to come to terms with their implied ethical bottom line, which, it seems to me, should be not an indifferentist relativism, but at best a tolerance of the fact that the values involved in different works of art and different ways of life are, as a matter of undoubted fact, incommensurate and often in conflict. But tolerance of the various claims of postmodernists, for example, isn't ipso facto relativist at all, though it is often confused with it. Tolerance is a principled willingness to put up with the expression and pursuit of beliefs that you know to be wrong, for the sake of some larger ideal, like freedom of inquiry, or the autonomy of others in the construction of their own narrative or identity, provided, I would say, that they don't harm others in the process. But no amount of tolerance or postmodernist skepticism should be allowed to conflict with the ideals expressed, for example, in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, disputable as some of them are, or the Geneva Convention. As I've argued throughout, postmodernism is a bit like a party manifesto. It is at base a set of beliefs which are not in fact held by all, and are unlikely to reflect the universal condition of men and women in contemporary society. And if we lack an antecedent faith in Marx plus Freud or some other ideology, it is impossible to generalize postmodernist beliefs as diagnosing the real conditions of our existence. And indeed, if we do this, we buy into just that kind of larger ideological commitment which it has been the aim of postmodernism to resist. As Hans Bertens, in The Idea of the Postmodern from 1994, so eloquently puts it, "Although the omnipresence of the postmodern and its advocates would seem to suggest otherwise, not everybody subscribes to the view that language constitutes rather than represents reality, that the autonomous and stable subject of modernity has been replaced by a postmodern agent whose identity is largely other-determined and always in process, that meaning has become social and provisional, or that knowledge only counts as such within a given discursive formation, that is, a given power structure." Alternatives. The postmodernist critique has worked very well as moral exhortation, but it has no convincing claim to a unique insight into the truth of our condition, or to an accurate and complete description of society. It is therefore important to see postmodernist ideas and achievements as part of a larger picture of interaction with other traditions of belief. In all the areas we have looked at, from philosophy through ethics to artistic activity, there are very vigorous alternative intellectual traditions outside those promoted by postmodernists, most notably the Anglo-American liberal tradition. I am thinking of authors like John Rawls, Joseph Raz, Michael Sandel, Stuart Hampshire, Amy Gutman, Martha Nussbaum, Will Kimlicka, John Gray, Ronald Dworkin, Brian Berry, and Michael Walzer. Richard Rorty seems to be the only Anglo-American philosopher known to most postmodernist theorists. The enduring achievements of postmodernism are therefore likely to be found not within philosophy or politics, or even in moral thought, but within the artistic culture. The politics of the postmodernist era will probably take care of itself as the conditions under which it became popular change. But what will remain, if some sense of history and tradition also remains, is a sense of postmodernism as a cultural phenomenon, which has left us over the last 30 years of its influence with a canon of major works, particularly from writers like Abish, Barthalme, Coover, and DeLillo, and on through the alphabet. A significant number of those working in the other arts surely have the same status as exemplars of some postmodernist ideas. Joseph Beuys, Christian Boltanski, Frank Gehry, Philip Glass, Jean-Luc Godard, Robert Rauschenberg, Richard Rogers, Cindy Sherman, Frank Stella, James Stirling, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and Wim Wenders among them. But it is important to remember that in the arts, too, alternative traditions persist, and for two main reasons. Firstly, because modernist traditions continue, and there are many artists who have learned something from postmodernism without being devoted followers of it. Some modernist movements, such as Dada and the use of Duchampian or found objects, constructivism, in its influence on minimalist or color field painting, and surrealism, in inspiring the postmodernist's collage of irrationally related images, as for examples in Rauschenberg, seem to have been fairly directly appropriated by postmodernists. Such resemblances and continuities from one period to another are never too difficult to find. There is nothing new under the sun. And the divergences into postmodernism from modernism here are a matter of the different values involved. Postmodernist surrealism doesn't have the overall theory of Freud to back it up, for example. And the postmodernist obsession with political difference and with art as politically significant made inevitable an attack upon the universalizing claim by modernists that there is pleasure, even if a merely individualist bourgeois one, to be taken in the immediate or formal properties of works of art. And yet, as I noted earlier, neo-expressionist painting could develop modernist features and thrive in this period, without any obvious complete allegiance to postmodernist doctrines, and the same goes for traditions of abstraction, and indeed of realism. Indeed, much of the significant artistic activity of the period since 1945, and more particularly for our purposes since 1970, managed a compromise between modernist and postmodernist ideas. Of course, there is going to be just as much difficulty in defining modernism in contrast to postmodernism as there is in defining postmodernism itself, and some artists are very difficult to categorize in this respect. For example, many of the most influential writers, like Milan Kundera, Italo Calvino, Salman Rushdie, John Barth, Julian Barnes, Mario Vargas Llosa, Margaret Atwood, and Umberto Eco, who include in their work many of the concerns of the period, are far from being out-and-out postmodernists. And the same goes for artists like Jennifer Bartlett, Anthony Cragg, Richard Diebenkorn, Eric Fischel, Howard Hodgkin, David Hockney, Bill Jacklin, and R.B. Kitaj. And many significant composers, such as John Adams, Harrison Birtwistle, Georgi Ligeti, and Witold Lutosławski, would fit in here. Hence, for example, the poise of the novels of Umberto Eco, who is himself an important postmodernist theorist, between modern and postmodern. His The Name of the Rose, from 1983, as a detective story, seems to thrive on the modernist quest for certainty. But in true postmodernist style, very little is discovered and the detective is defeated, as Eco declares in the postscript. In the novel, William of Baskerville says he arrived at the detection of Jorge by mistake. He thought there was an apocalyptic pattern in the evidence, but it was in fact accidental. He solves many sub-mysteries, but the plot as a whole only through an ironic misinterpretation. But once he is played by Sean Connery in the film of the book, he seems to succeed, because a commercial film no doubt could not afford to bring about too many postmodernist disappointments in its audience. Many distinguished writers like Eco have some very obvious postmodernist elements, but they also have a number of more enduring conservative features, which indeed help to place them more nearly at the center of the culture, as it is very likely to wish to remember itself. There is plenty of great art outside postmodernism. The staple of many people's artistic experience still lies within a form of liberal realism, which keeps better faith than the postmodernists with the possibility of arriving at the truth, and at a truth where humanitarian as well as political considerations are relevant. Traditionalist liberal novelists like John Updike, Bernard Malamud, Norman Mailer, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, Heinrich Böll, and Ian McEwan have produced works which are still of immense importance for many people's understanding of contemporary life, as have John Ashbery, Francis Bacon, Ingmar Bergman, Lucian Freud, Gunter Grass, Harold Pinter, François Truffaut, and others in theirs. These are just disputable lists of names, but they are here as a reminder of the ways in which outside theories, or even explicitly political commitments, we make up canons as individuals to record and preserve the values that matter for us. Postmodernist art has been a very significant, but not obviously predominating part of all this activity. It has nevertheless been of immense importance in reviving the battle between skepticism and belief, between liberalism and the Marxist left, between strategies for ideological imposition and for the preservation of autonomous identity. It has, in these respects, borne by far the greatest burden in providing a specification and critique of the way we live now since the 1960s. Its thinkers may have had little purchase upon, and I would guess even less influence upon, the practical everyday activities of professional politicians, though they have had great influence in bringing about an increasingly liberal approach to the identity politics of gender and ethnicity. As cultural critics, they have rightly tended to see political and moral considerations as a quarrel about the legitimacy of particular kinds of representational, image-dominated activity. In this book, I have tried to give an account and a critique of postmodernism, because I believe that the period of its greatest influence is now over. Its founding fathers are in their turn encountering the skepticism of a new generation. That is why I have tried to concentrate above on those postmodernist ideas which I judge to have the longest potential life. For the battles around postmodernism, quite unlike the battles around modernism, have had the distinctive feature that, thanks to the rise of theory, they raise perennial philosophical questions. It is this underlying deep dialectic between reason and skepticism, reality and the image, the political powers of inclusion and exclusion, which is central to postmodernist thought, and it is a dialectic that will continue to engage us for some time to come.
This concludes Postmodernism by Christopher Butler, narrated by Christine Williams. Copyright 2002 by Christopher Butler. Production copyright by Audible. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2021 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.